Populorum Progressio Encyclical of Pope Paul VI on the Development of Peoples, March 26, 1967. To the bishops, priests, religious, and faithful of the whole Catholic world, and to all men of goodwill, honored brothers and dear sons, health and apostolic benediction. The progressive development of peoples is an object of deep interest and concern to the Church. This is particularly true in the case of those peoples who are trying to escape the ravages of hunger, poverty, endemic disease and ignorance, of those who are seeking a larger share in the benefits of civilization and a more active improvement of their human qualities, of those who are consciously striving for fuller growth. The Church is concerned with an even clearer awareness, since the Second Vatican Council, of the demands imposed by Christ's Gospel in this area. The Church judges it her duty to help all men explore this serious problem in all its dimensions, and to impress upon them the need for concerted action at this critical juncture. 2. Our recent predecessors did not fail to do their duty in this area. Their noteworthy messages shed the light of the Gospel on contemporary social questions. There was Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, 1, Pius XI's encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, 2, Pius XII's radio message to the world, 3, and John 23's two encyclicals, Mater et Magistra 4, and Pacem in Terris 5. A problem for all men. 3. Today it is most important for people to understand and appreciate that the social question ties all men together, in every part of the world. John 23 stated this clearly. 6. And Vatican II confirmed it in its pastoral constitution on the Church in the world of today. 7. The seriousness and urgency of these teachings must be recognized without delay. The hungry nations of the world cry out to the peoples blessed with abundance. And the Church, cut to the quick by this cry, asks each and every man to hear his brother's plea and answer it lovingly. Our journeys. 4. Before we became Pope, we traveled to Latin America 1960, and Africa 1962. There we saw the perplexing problems that vex and besiege these continents, which are otherwise full of life and promise. On being elected Pope, we became the father of all men. We made trips to Palestine and India, gaining first-hand knowledge of the difficulties that these age-old civilizations must face in their struggle for further development. Before the close of the Second Vatican Council, providential circumstances allowed Versus to address the United Nations and to plead the case of the impoverished nations before that distinguished assembly. Justice and peace. 5. Even more recently, we sought to fulfill the wishes of the Council and to demonstrate the Holy See's concern for the developing nations. To do this, we felt it was necessary to add another pontifical commission to the Church's central administration. The purpose of this commission is to awaken in the people of God full awareness of their mission today. In this way they can further the progress of poor nations and international social justice, as well as help less developed nations to contribute to their own development. 8. The name of this commission, Justice and Peace, aptly describes its program and its goal. We are sure that all men of good will want to join our fellow Catholics and fellow Christians in carrying out this program. So today we earnestly urge all men to pool their ideas and their activities for man's complete development and the development of all mankind. Man's complete development. 6. Today we see men trying to secure a sure food supply, cures for diseases, and steady employment. We see them trying to eliminate every ill, to remove every obstacle which offends man's dignity. They are continually striving to exercise greater personal responsibility, to do more, learn more, and have more, so that they might increase their personal worth. And yet, at the same time, a large number of them live amid conditions which frustrate these legitimate desires. Moreover, those nations which have recently gained independence find that political freedom is not enough. They must also acquire the social and economic structures and processes that accord with man's nature and activity, if their citizens are to achieve personal growth, and if their country is to take its rightful place in the international community. Effects of colonialism. 7. Though insufficient for the immensity and urgency of the task, the means inherited from the past are not totally useless. It is true that colonizing nations were sometimes concerned with nothing save their own interests, their own power and their own prestige. Their departure left the economy of these countries in precarious imbalanced one-crop economy, for example, which is at the mercy of sudden, wide-ranging fluctuations in market prices. Certain types of colonialism surely caused harm, and paved the way for further troubles. On the other hand, we must also reserve a word of praise for those colonizers whose skills and technical know-how brought benefits to many untamed lands, and whose work survives to this day. The structural machinery they introduced was not fully developed or perfected, but it did help to reduce ignorance and disease, to promote communication, and to improve living conditions. The widening gap. 8. Granted all this, it is only too clear that these structures are no match for the harsh economic realities of today. And unless the existing machinery is modified, the disparity between rich and poor nations will increase rather than diminish. The rich nations are progressing with rapid strides, while the poor nations move forward at a slow pace. The imbalance grows with each passing day. While some nations produce a food surplus, other nations are in desperate need of food, or are unsure of their export market. Signs of social unrest. 9. At the same time, social unrest has gradually spread throughout the world. The acute restlessness engulfing the poorer classes in countries that are now being industrialized has spread to other regions where agriculture is the mainstay of the economy. The farmer is painfully aware of his wretched lot. 9. Then there are the flagrant inequalities not merely in the enjoyment of possessions, but even more in the exercise of power. In certain regions a privileged minority enjoys the refinements of life, while the rest of the inhabitants, impoverished and disunited, are deprived of almost all possibility of acting on their own initiative and responsibility, and often subsist in living and working conditions unworthy of the human person. 10. Cultural conflicts. 10. Moreover, traditional culture comes into conflict with the advanced techniques of modern industrialization. Social structures out of tune with today's demands are threatened with extinction. For the older generation, the rigid structures of traditional culture are the necessary mainstay of one's personal and family life. They cannot be abandoned. The younger generation, on the other hand, regards them as useless obstacles, and rejects them to embrace new forms of societal life. The conflict between generations leads to a tragic dilemma, either to preserve traditional beliefs and structures, and reject social progress, or to embrace foreign technology and foreign culture, and reject ancestral traditions with their wealth of humanism. The sad fact is that we often see the older moral, spiritual and religious values give way without finding any place in the new scheme of things. Concomitant dangers. 11. In such troubled times some people are strongly tempted by the alluring, but deceitful promises of would-be saviors. Who does not see the concomitant dangers, public upheavals, civil insurrection, the drift toward totalitarian ideologies? These are the realities of the question under study here, and their gravity must surely be apparent to everyone. The Church in Development. 12. True to the teaching and example of her divine founder, who cited the preaching of the gospel to the poor as a sign of his mission, 12. The Church has never failed to foster the human progress of the nations to which she brings faith and Christ. Besides erecting sacred edifices, her missionaries have also promoted construction of hospitals, sanitariums, schools, and universities. By teaching the native population how to take full advantage of natural resources, the missionaries often protected them from the greed of foreigners. We would certainly admit that this work was sometimes far from perfect, since it was the work of men. The missionaries sometimes intermingled the thought patterns and behavior patterns of their native land with the authentic message of Christ. Yet, for all this, they did protect and promote indigenous institutions, and many of them pioneered in promoting the country's material and cultural progress. We need only mention the efforts of Père Charles de Foucault. He compiled a valuable dictionary of the Tuareg language, and his charity won him the title, Everyone's Brother. So we deem it fitting to praise those oft-forgotten pioneers who were motivated by love for Christ, just as we honor their imitators and successors who today continue to put themselves at the generous and unselfish service of those to whom they preach the gospel. The present need. 13. In the present day, however, individual and group effort within these countries is no longer enough. The world situation requires the concerted effort of everyone, a thorough examination of every facet of the problem, social, economic, cultural and spiritual. The Church, which has long experience in human affairs, and has no desire to be involved in the political activities of any nation, seeks but one goal: to carry forward the work of Christ under the lead of the befriending Spirit. And Christ entered this world to give witness to the truth, to save, not to judge, to serve, not to be served. 12. Founded to build the kingdom of heaven on earth, rather than to acquire temporal power, the Church openly avows that the two powers, Church and State, are distinct from one another, that each is supreme in its own sphere of competency. 13. But since the Church does dwell among men, she has the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times, and of interpreting them in the light of the gospel. 14. Sharing the noblest aspirations of men in suffering, when she sees these aspirations not satisfied, she wishes to help them attain their full realization. So she offers man her distinctive contribution, a global perspective on man and human realities. Authentic development. 14. The development we speak of here cannot be restricted to economic growth alone. To be authentic, it must be well-rounded. It must foster the development of each man, and of the whole man. As an eminent specialist on this question has rightly said, we cannot allow economics to be separated from human realities, nor development from the civilization in which it takes place. What counts for us is man, each individual man, each human group, and humanity as a whole. 15. Personal responsibility. 15. In God's plan, every man is born to seek self-fulfillment, for every human life is called to some task by God. At birth, a human being possesses certain aptitudes and abilities in germinal form, and these qualities are to be cultivated, so that they may bear fruit. By developing these traits through formal education of personal effort, the individual works his way toward the goal set for him by the Creator. Endowed with intellect and free will, each man is responsible for his self-fulfillment even as he is for his salvation. He is helped, and sometimes hindered, by his teachers and those around him. Yet whatever be the outside influences exerted on him, he is the chief architect of his own success or failure. Utilizing only his talent and willpower, each man can grow in humanity, enhance his personal worth, and perfect himself. Man's supernatural destiny. 16. Self-development, however, is not left up to man's option. Just as the whole of creation is ordered toward its Creator, so too the rational creature should of his own accord direct his life to God, the first truth and the highest good. Thus human self-fulfillment may be said to sum up our obligations. Moreover, this harmonious integration of our human nature, carried through by personal effort and responsible activity, is destined for a higher state of perfection. United with the life-giving Christ, man's life is newly enhanced. It acquires a transcendent humanism which surpasses its nature and bestows new fullness of life. This is the highest goal of human self-fulfillment. Ties with all men. 17. Each man is also a member of society, hence he belongs to the community of man. It is not just certain individuals, but all men who are called to further the development of human society as a whole. Civilizations spring up, flourish and die. As the waves of the sea gradually creep farther and farther in along the shoreline, so the human race inches its way forward through history. We are the heirs of earlier generations, and we reap benefits from the efforts of our contemporaries. We are under obligation to all men. Therefore, we cannot disregard the welfare of those who will come after us to increase the human family. The reality of human solidarity brings us not only benefits but also obligations. Development in proper perspective. 18. Man's personal and collective fulfillment could be jeopardized if the proper scale of values were not maintained. The pursuit of life's necessities is quite legitimate. Hence we are duty-bound to do the work which enables us to obtain them. If anyone is unwilling to work, do not let him eat. L6, but the acquisition of worldly goods can lead men to greed, to the unrelenting desire for more, to the pursuit of greater personal power. Rich and poor alike, be they individuals, families or nations, can fall prey to avarice and soul-stifling materialism. Latent dangers. 19. Neither individuals nor nations should regard the possession of more and more goods as the ultimate objective. Every kind of progress is a two-edged sword. It is necessary, if man is to grow as a human being, yet it can also enslave him, if he comes to regard it as the supreme good, and cannot look beyond it. When this happens, men harden their hearts, shut out others from their minds and gather together solely for reasons of self-interest, rather than out of friendship. Dissension and disunity follow soon after. Thus the exclusive pursuit of material possessions prevents man's growth as a human being, and stands in opposition to his true grandeur. Avarice, in individuals and in nations, is the most obvious form of stultified moral development. A new humanism needed. 20. If development calls for an ever-growing number of technical experts, even more necessary still is the deep thought and reflection of wise men in search of a new humanism, one which will enable our contemporaries to enjoy the higher values of love and friendship, of prayer and contemplation. 17. And thus find themselves. This is what will guarantee man's authentic development, his transition from less than human conditions to truly human ones. The scale of values. 21. What are less than human conditions? The material poverty of those who lack the bare necessities of life, and the moral poverty of those who are crushed under the weight of their own self-love, oppressive political structures resulting from the abuse of ownership or the improper exercise of power, from the exploitation of the worker or unjust transactions. What are truly human conditions? The rise from poverty to the acquisition of life's necessities, the elimination of social ills, broadening the horizons of knowledge, acquiring refinement and culture. From there one can go on to acquire a growing awareness of other people's dignity, a taste for the spirit of poverty, elate, an active interest in the common good, and a desire for peace. Then man can acknowledge the highest values and God himself, their author and end. Finally and above all, there is faith, God's gift to men of goodwill, and our loving unity in Christ, who calls all men to share God's life as sons of the living God, the Father of all men. Issues and principles. 22. In the very first pages of Scripture we read these words, "Fill the earth, and subdue it." 19. This teaches us that the whole of creation is for man, that he has been charged to give it meaning by his intelligent activity, to complete and perfect it by his own efforts, and to his own advantage. Now if the earth truly was created to provide man with the necessities of life and the tools for his own progress, it follows that every man has the right to glean what he needs from the earth. The recent council reiterated this truth. God intended the earth and everything in it for the use of all human beings and peoples. Thus, under the leadership of justice, and in the company of charity, created goods should flow fairly to all. 20. All other rights, whatever they may be, including the rights of property and free trade, are to be subordinated to this principle. They should in no way hinder it. In fact, they should actively facilitate its implementation. Redirecting these rights back to their original purpose must be regarded as an important and urgent social duty. The use of private property. 23. He who has the goods of this world, and sees his brother in need, and closes his heart to him, how does the love of God abide in him? 21. Everyone knows that the fathers of the church laid down the duty of the rich toward the poor in no uncertain terms. As Saint Ambrose put it, "You are not making a gift of what is yours to the poor man, but you are giving him back what is his." You have been appropriating things that are meant to be for the common use of everyone. The earth belongs to everyone, not to the rich. 22. These words indicate that the right to private property is not absolute and unconditional. No one may appropriate surplus goods solely for his own private use when others lack the bare necessities of life. In short, as the fathers of the church and other eminent theologians tell us, the right of private property may never be exercised to the detriment of the common good. When private gain and basic community needs conflict with one another, it is for the public authorities to seek a solution to these questions, with the active involvement of individual citizens and social groups. 23. The common good. 24. If certain landed estates impede the general prosperity, because they are extensive, unused or poorly used, or because they bring hardship to peoples, or are detrimental to the interests of the country, the common good sometimes demands their expropriation. Vatican II affirms this emphatically. 24. At the same time it clearly teaches that income thus derived is not for man's capricious use, and that the exclusive pursuit of personal gain is prohibited. Consequently, it is not permissible for citizens who have garnered sizable income from the resources and activities of their own nation to deposit a large portion of their income in foreign countries for the sake of their own private gain alone, taking no account of their country's interests. In doing this, they clearly wrong their country. 25. The value of industrialization. 25. The introduction of industrialization, which is necessary for economic growth and human progress, is both a sign of development and a spur to it. By dint of intelligent thought and hard work, man gradually uncovers the hidden laws of nature and learns to make better use of natural resources. As he takes control over his way of life, he is stimulated to undertake new investigations and fresh discoveries, to take prudent risks and launch new ventures, to act responsibly and give of himself unselfishly. Unbridled liberalism. 26. However, certain concepts have somehow arisen out of these new conditions and insinuated themselves into the fabric of human society. These concepts present profit as the chief spur to economic progress, free competition as the guiding norm of economics, and private ownership of the means of production as an absolute right, having no limits nor concomitant social obligations. This unbridled liberalism paves the way for a particular type of tyranny, rightly condemned by our predecessor Pius XI, for it results in the international imperialism of money. 26. Such improper manipulations of economic forces can never be condemned enough. Let it be said once again that economics is supposed to be in the service of men. 27. But if it is true that a type of capitalism, as it is commonly called, has given rise to hardships, unjust practices, and fratricidal conflicts that persist to this day, it would be a mistake to attribute these evils to the rise of industrialization itself, for they really derive from the pernicious economic concepts that grew up along with it. We must in all fairness acknowledge the vital role played by labor systemization and industrial organization in the task of development. Nobility of work. 27. The concept of work can turn into an exaggerated mystique. Yet, for all that, it is something willed and approved by God. Fashioned in the image of his Creator, men must cooperate with him in completing the work of creation and engraving on the earth the spiritual imprint which he himself has received. 25. God gave man intelligence, sensitivity and the power of thought, tools with which to finish and perfect the work he began. Every worker is, to some extent, a creator, be he artist, craftsman, executive, laborer, or farmer. Bent over a material that resists his efforts, the worker leaves his imprint on it, at the same time developing his own powers of persistence, inventiveness, and concentration. Further, when work is done in common, when hope, hardship, ambition, and joy are shared, it brings together and firmly unites the wills, minds and hearts of men. In its accomplishment, men find themselves to be brothers. 29. Dangers and ideals. 28. Work, too, has a double edge. Since it promises money, pleasure, and power, it stirs up selfishness in some, and incites others to revolt. On the other hand, it also fosters a professional outlook, a sense of duty, and love of neighbor. Even though it is now being organized more scientifically and efficiently, it still can threaten man's dignity and enslave him, for work is human only if it results from man's use of intellect and free will. Our predecessor John 23 stressed the urgent need of restoring dignity to the worker and making him a real partner in the common task. Every effort must be made to ensure that the enterprise is indeed a true human community, concerned about the needs, the activities and the standing of each of its members. 30. Considered from a Christian point of view, work has an even loftier connotation. It is directed to the establishment of a supernatural order here on earth. 31. A task that will not be completed until we all unite to form that perfect manhood of which Saint Paul speaks, the mature measure of the fullness of Christ. 32. Balanced progress required. 29. We must make haste. Too many people are suffering. While some make progress, others stand still or move backwards, and the gap between them is widening. However, the work must proceed in measured steps, if the proper equilibrium is to be maintained. Makeshift agrarian reforms may fall short of their goal. Hasty industrialization can undermine vital institutions and produce social evils, causing a setback to true human values. Reform, not revolution. 30. The injustice of certain situations cries out for God's attention. Lacking the bare necessities of life, whole nations are under the thumb of others. They cannot act on their own initiative. They cannot exercise personal responsibility. They cannot work toward a higher degree of cultural refinement or a greater participation in social and public life. They are sorely tempted to redress these insults to their human nature by violent means. 31. Everyone knows, however, that revolutionary uprisings, except where there is manifest long-standing tyranny which would do great damage to fundamental personal rights and dangerous harm to the common good of the country, engender new injustices, introduce new inequities, and bring new disasters. The evil situation that exists, and it surely is evil, may not be dealt with in such a way that an even worse situation results. A task for everyone. 32. We want to be clearly understood on this point. The present state of affairs must be confronted boldly, and its concomitant injustices must be challenged and overcome. Continuing development calls for bold innovations that will work profound changes. The critical state of affairs must be corrected for the better without delay. Everyone must lend a ready hand to this task, particularly those who can do most by reason of their education, their office, or their authority. They should set a good example by contributing part of their own goods, as several of our brother bishops have done. 33. In this way they will be responsive to men's longings and faithful to the Holy Spirit, because the ferment of the gospel too has aroused and continues to arouse in man's heart the irresistible requirements of his dignity. 34. Programs and planning. 33. Individual initiative alone and the interplay of competition will not ensure satisfactory development. We cannot proceed to increase the wealth and power of the rich while we entrench the needy in their poverty and add to the woes of the oppressed. Organized programs are necessary for directing, stimulating, coordinating, supplying, and integrating. 35. The work of individuals and intermediary organizations. It is for the public authorities to establish and lay down the desired goals, the plans to be followed, and the methods to be used in fulfilling them, and it is also their task to stimulate the efforts of those involved in this common activity. But they must also see to it that private initiative and intermediary organizations are involved in this work. In this way they will avoid total collectivization and the dangers of a planned economy which might threaten human liberty and obstruct the exercise of man's basic human rights. The ultimate purpose. 34. Organized programs designed to increase productivity should have but one aim: to serve human nature. They should reduce inequities, eliminate discrimination, free men from the bonds of servitude, and thus give them the capacity, in the sphere of temporal realities, to improve their lot, to further their moral growth and to develop their spiritual endowments. When we speak of development, we should mean social progress as well as economic growth. It is not enough to increase the general fund of wealth and then distribute it more fairly. It is not enough to develop technology so that the earth may become a more suitable living place for human beings. The mistakes of those who led the way should help those now on the road to development to avoid certain dangers. The reign of technology technocracy, as it is called, can cause as much harm to the world of tomorrow as liberalism did to the world of yesteryear. Economics and technology are meaningless if they do not benefit man, desperate as he they are to serve. Man is truly human, only if he is the master of his own actions and the judge of their worth, only if he is the architect of his own progress. He must act according to his God-given nature, freely accepting its potentials and its claims upon him. Basic education. 35. We can even say that economic growth is dependent on social progress, the goal to which it aspires, and that basic education is the first objective for any nation seeking to develop itself. Lack of education is as serious as lack of food. The illiterate is a starved spirit. When someone learns how to read and write, he is equipped to do a job and to shoulder a profession, to develop self-confidence, and realize that he can progress along with others. As we said in our message to the UNESCO meeting at Tehran, literacy is the first and most basic tool for personal enrichment and social integration, and it is society's most valuable tool for furthering development and economic progress. 36. We also rejoice at the good work accomplished in this field by private initiative, by the public authorities, and by international organizations. These are the primary agents of development, because they enable man to act for himself. Role of the family. 36. Man is not really himself, however, except within the framework of society, and there the family plays the basic and most important role. The family's influence may have been excessive at some periods of history, and in some places, to the extent that it was exercised to the detriment of the fundamental rights of the individual. Yet time-honored social frameworks, proper to the developing nations, are still necessary for a while, even as their excessive strictures are gradually relaxed. The natural family, stable and monogamous as fashioned by God. 37. And sanctified by Christianity, in which different generations live together, helping each other to acquire greater wisdom and to harmonize personal rights with other social needs, is the basis of society. 38. Population growth. 37. There is no denying that the accelerated rate of population growth brings many added difficulties to the problems of development, where the size of the population grows more rapidly than the quantity of available resources to such a degree that things seem to have reached an impasse. In such circumstances, people are inclined to apply drastic remedies to reduce the birth rate. There is no doubt that public authorities can intervene in this matter within the bounds of their competence. They can instruct citizens on this subject and adopt appropriate measures, so long as these are in conformity with the dictates of the moral law and the rightful freedom of married couples is preserved completely intact. When the inalienable right of marriage and of procreation is taken away, so is human dignity. Finally, it is for parents to take a thorough look at the matter and decide upon the number of their children. This is an obligation they take upon themselves before their children already born, and before the community to which they belong, following the dictates of their own consciences informed by God's law, authentically interpreted and bolstered by their trust in Him. 39. Professional organizations. 38. In the task of development, man finds the family to be the first and most basic social structure, but he is often helped by professional organizations. While such organizations are founded to aid and assist their members, they bear a heavy responsibility for the task of education which they can and must carry out. In training and developing individual men, they do much to cultivate in them an awareness of the common good, and of its demands upon all. 39. Every form of social action involves some doctrine, and the Christian rejects that which is based on the materialistic and atheistic philosophy, namely one which shows no respect for a religious outlook on life, for freedom or human dignity. So long as these higher values are preserved intact, however, the existence of a variety of professional organizations and trade unions is permissible. Variety may even help to preserve freedom and create friendly rivalry. We gladly commend those people who unselfishly serve their brothers by working in such organizations. Cultural institutions. 40. Cultural institutions also do a great deal to further the work of development. Their important role was stressed by the Council. The future of the world stands in peril unless wiser men are forthcoming. It should also be pointed out that many nations, poorer in economic goods are quite rich in wisdom, and can offer noteworthy advantages to others. 40. Every country, rich or poor, has a cultural tradition handed down from past generations. This tradition includes institutions required by life in the world, and higher manifestations artistic, intellectual and religious of the life of the spirit. When the latter embody truly human values, it would be a great mistake to sacrifice them for the sake of the former. Any group of people who would consent to let this happen would be giving up the better portion of their heritage. In order to live, they would be giving up their reason for living. Christ's question is directed to nations also. What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world, but suffer the loss of his own soul? 41. Avoiding past temptations. 41. The poorer nations can never be too much on guard against the temptation posed by the wealthier nations. For these nations, with their favorable results from a highly technical and culturally developed civilization, provide an example of work and diligence with temporal prosperity the main pursuit. Not that temporal prosperity of itself precludes the activity of the human spirit. Indeed, with it, the human spirit, being less subjected to material things, can be more easily drawn to the worship and contemplation of the Creator. 42. On the other hand, modern civilization itself often complicates the approach to God, not for any essential reason, but because it is so much engrossed in worldly affairs. 43. The developing nations must choose wisely from among the things that are offered to them. They must test and reject false values that would tarnish a truly human way of life, while accepting noble and useful values, in order to develop them in their own distinctive way, along with their own indigenous heritage. A full-bodied humanism. 42. The ultimate goal is a full-bodied humanism. 44. And does this not mean the fulfillment of the whole man, and of every man? A narrow humanism, closed in on itself, and not open to the values of the Spirit, and to God, who is their source, could achieve apparent success, for man can set about organizing terrestrial realities without God, but, closed off from God, they will end up being directed against man. A humanism closed off from other realities becomes inhuman. 45. True humanism points the way toward God, and acknowledges the task to which we are called, the task which offers us the real meaning of human life. Man is not the ultimate measure of man. Man becomes truly man only by passing beyond himself. In the words of Pascal, man infinitely surpasses man. 46. 2. The common development of mankind. 43. Development of the individual necessarily entails a joint effort for the development of the human race as a whole. At Bombay we said, man must meet man, nation must meet nation, as brothers and sisters, as children of God. In this mutual understanding and friendship, in this sacred communion, we must also begin to work together to build the common future of the human race. 47. We also urge men to explore concrete and practicable ways of organizing and coordinating their efforts, so that available resources might be shared with others. In this way genuine bonds between nations might be forged. 3 major duties. 44. This duty concerns first and foremost the wealthier nations. Their obligations stem from the human and supernatural brotherhood of man, and present a threefold obligation. 1. Mutual solidarity, the aid that the richer nations must give to developing nations. 2. Social justice, the rectification of trade relations between strong and weak nations. 3. Universal charity, the effort to build a more humane world community, where all can give and receive, and where the progress of some is not bought at the expense of others. The matter is urgent, for on it depends the future of world civilization. Aid to developing nations. 45. If a brother or a sister be naked, and in want of daily food, says Saint James, and one of you say to them, go in peace, be warm and filled, yet you do not give them what is necessary for the body, what does it profit? 48. Today no one can be unaware of the fact that on some continents countless men and women are ravished by hunger and countless children are undernourished. Many children die at an early age, many more of them find their physical and mental growth retarded. Thus whole populations are immersed in pitiable circumstances and lose heart. 46. Anxious appeals for help have already been voiced. That of our predecessor John 23 was warmly received. 49. We reiterated his sentiments in our Christmas message of 1963, 50, and again in 1966 on behalf of India. 51, the work of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations FAO, has been encouraged by the Holy See, and has found generous support. Our own organization, Caritas Internationalis, is at work all over the world. Many Catholics, at the urging of our brother bishops, have contributed unstintingly to the assistance of the needy, and have gradually widened the circle of those they call neighbors. A world of free men. 47. But these efforts, as well as public and private allocations of gifts, loans, and investments, are not enough. It is not just a question of eliminating hunger and reducing poverty. It is not just a question of fighting wretched conditions, though this is an urgent and necessary task. It involves building a human community, where men can live truly human lives, free from discrimination on account of race, religion, or nationality, free from servitude to other men, or to natural forces which they cannot yet control satisfactorily. It involves building a human community, where liberty is not an idle word, where the needy Lazarus can sit down with the rich man at the same banquet table. 52. On the part of the rich man, it calls for great generosity, willing sacrifice and diligent effort. Each man must examine his conscience, which sounds a new call in our present times. Is he prepared to support, at his own expense, projects and undertakings designed to help the needy? Is he prepared to pay higher taxes, so that public authorities may expend their efforts in the work of development? Is he prepared to pay more for imported goods, so that the foreign producer may make a fairer profit? Is he prepared to emigrate from his homeland if necessary, and if he is young, in order to help the emerging nations? A national duty. 48. The duty of promoting human solidarity also falls upon the shoulders of nations. It is a very important duty of the advanced nations to help the developing nations. 53. This conciliar teaching must be implemented. While it is proper that a nation be the first to enjoy the God-given fruits of its own labor, no nation may dare to hoard its riches for its own use alone. Each and every nation must produce more and better goods and products, so that all its citizens may live truly human lives, and so that it may contribute to the common development of the human race. Considering the mounting indigence of less developed countries, it is only fitting that a prosperous nation set aside some of the goods it has produced, in order to alleviate their needs, and that it train educators, engineers, technicians and scholars who will contribute their knowledge and their skill to these less fortunate countries. Superfluous wealth. 49. We must repeat that the superfluous goods of wealthier nations ought to be placed at the disposal of poorer nations. The rule, by virtue of which in times past those nearest us were to be helped in time of need, applies today to all the needy throughout the world. And the prospering peoples will be the first to benefit from this. Continuing avarice on their part will rouse the judgment of God and the wrath of the poor, with consequences no one can foresee. If prosperous nations continue to be jealous of their own advantage alone, they will jeopardize their highest values, sacrificing the pursuit of excellence to the acquisition of possessions. We might well apply to them the parable of the rich man. His fields yielded an abundant harvest and he did not know where to store it, but God said to him, "Fool, this very night your soul will be demanded from you." 54. Concerted planning. 50. If these efforts are to be successful, they cannot be disparate and disorganized, nor should they vie with one another, for the sake of power or prestige. The times call for coordinated planning of projects and programs, which are much more effective than occasional efforts promoted by individual goodwill. As we said above, studies must be made, goals must be defined, methods and means must be chosen, and the work of select men must be coordinated. Only then will present needs be met, and future demands anticipated. Moreover, such planned programs do more than promote economic and social progress. They give force and meaning to the work undertaken, put due order into human life, and thus enhance man's dignity and his capabilities. A World Fund. 51. A further step must be taken. When we were at Bombay for the Eucharistic Congress, we asked world leaders to set aside part of their military expenditures for a World Fund, to relieve the needs of impoverished peoples. 55. What is true for the immediate war against poverty, is also true for the work of national development. Only a concerted effort on the part of all nations, embodied in and carried out by this World Fund, will stop these senseless rivalries and promote fruitful, friendly dialogue between nations. 52. It is certainly all right to maintain bilateral and multilateral agreements. Through such agreements, ties of dependence and feelings of jealousy holdovers from the era of colonialism give way to friendly relationships of true solidarity, that are based on juridical and political equality. But such agreements would be free of all suspicion, if they were integrated into an overall policy of worldwide collaboration. The member nations, who benefit from these agreements, would have less reason for fear or mistrust. They would not have to worry that financial or technical assistance was being used as a cover for some new form of colonialism that would threaten their civil liberty, exert economic pressure on them, or create a new power group with controlling influence. 53. Is it not plain to everyone that such a fund would reduce the need for those other expenditures that are motivated by fear and stubborn pride? Countless millions are starving. Countless families are destitute. Countless men are steeped in ignorance. Countless people need schools, hospitals, and homes worthy of the name. In such circumstances, we cannot tolerate public and private expenditures of a wasteful nature. We cannot but condemn lavish displays of wealth by nations or individuals. We cannot approve a debilitating arms race. It is our solemn duty to speak out against them. If only world leaders would listen to us before it is too late. Dialogue between nations. 54. All nations must initiate the dialogue which we called for in our first encyclical, Ecclesiam Suam. 56. A dialogue between those who contribute aid and those who receive it will permit a well-balanced assessment of the support to be provided, taking into consideration not only the generosity and the available wealth of the donor nations, but also the real needs of the receiving countries and the use to which the financial assistance can be put. Developing countries will thus no longer risk being overwhelmed by debts whose repayment swallows up the greater part of their gains. Rates of interest and time for repayment of the loan could be so arranged as not to be too great a burden on either party, taking into account free gifts, interest-free or low-interest loans, and the time needed for liquidating the debts. The donors could certainly ask for assurances as to how the money will be used. It should be used for some mutually acceptable purpose, and with reasonable hope of success, for there is no question of backing idlers and parasites. On the other hand, the recipients would certainly have the right to demand that no one interfere in the internal affairs of their government, or disrupt their social order. As sovereign nations, they are entitled to manage their own affairs, to fashion their own policies, and to choose their own form of government. In other words, what is needed is mutual cooperation among nations, freely undertaken, where each enjoys equal dignity, and can help to shape a world community truly worthy of man. An urgent task. 55. This task might seem impossible in those regions where the daily struggle for subsistence absorbs the attention of the family, where people are at a loss to find work that might improve their lot during their remaining days on earth. These people must be given every possible help. They must be encouraged to take steps for their own betterment and to seek out the means that will enable them to do so. This common task undoubtedly calls for concerted, continuing and courageous effort. But let there be no doubt about it. It is an urgent task, the very life of needy nations, civil peace in the developing countries, and world peace itself are at stake. Equity in trade relations. 56. Efforts are being made to help the developing nations financially and technologically. Some of these efforts are considerable. Yet all these efforts will prove to be vain and useless if their results are nullified to a large extent by the unstable trade relations between rich and poor nations. The latter will have no grounds for hope or trust if they fear that what is being given them with one hand is being taken away with the other. Growing distortion. 57. Highly industrialized nations export their own manufactured products, for the most part. Less developed nations, on the other hand, have nothing to sell but raw materials and agricultural crops. As a result of technical progress, the price of manufactured products is rising rapidly, and they find a ready market.